This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
Another day, another dollar decline. For businesses, that's a two-sided coin. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, April 24th. Good to have you with us. The week just begun is a big one for corporate earnings. We'll hear from a lot of tech companies in particular, including Alphabet, Microsoft, Meta, and Amazon, but also UPS, PepsiCo, and Boeing. Analysts tuning in to earning calls will be listening for any color on job cuts and the prospects of a recession. One factor that could be boosting profits at many big U.S. companies this year is the weakening dollar. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Up until around last September, the dollar's value had been rising. That's because a lot of investors were buying U.S. government bonds, which paid more interest, thanks to the Federal Reserve's rate hikes.
But when we enter the, you know, later part of 2022, and we go into that fourth quarter, all of a sudden, the other central banks begin to catch up.
That's Christopher Vecchio, head of futures and foreign exchange at the options researcher Tasty Live. The dollar's value has been falling in the time since, especially since this year, the Federal Reserve is slowing down its rate hikes.
And now we're seeing other central banks like the ECB and perhaps even the Bank of England having to do a little bit more to fight inflation than previously anticipated.
A weaker U.S. dollar makes American products more competitive overseas. Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners says companies also get more dollars when they bring overseas profits back home.
A company like McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, all of these, they have huge sales outside the country. So these companies benefit.
Thing is, a weaker U.S. dollar also makes it more expensive to make overseas investments. Christopher Gilchrist, principal analyst at Forrester Research, says an American company that makes things in another country will have to pay more for labor and machinery.
And so as the dollar gets weaker, where they have assets globally could expose them to having to spend a premium just to keep it going at a steady state.
And for anyone in the U.S. that imports products, a weak dollar doesn't go as far. Catherine Reynolds imports tile for Palmetto Tile Distributors in South Carolina, and she buys a lot of her tile from factories in Europe.
Most of my factories will charge in euros and we convert it over. So when that conversion rate is done, I end up paying more.
Reynolds says that's yet another factor that's causing her to raise prices this year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a mixed bag. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It was a sad weekend for employees and loyal customers of Bed Bath & Beyond. After months of speculation about its fate, the retail chain officially filed for bankruptcy. Struggles with e-commerce and the pandemic proved too much for the once ubiquitous staple of suburban shopping malls. Barring an unlikely rescue, the company says it'll begin closing its 360 locations across the country, which got Marketplace's Matt Levin wondering who's going to move in to all those big, boxy storefronts.
Bed Bath & Beyond apparently didn't have enough demand for high thread count sheets or kitschy welcome mats, but demand for their retail space may be pretty high. Ermengarde jabbers with Moody's Analytics.
Strip malls in prime suburban locations are actually doing remarkably well. This actually gives these retail landlords the opportunity to potentially raise the rent a little bit.
Retail vacancy rates in most markets are actually lower than they were before the pandemic, according to the commercial real estate firm JLL, a marketplace underwriter. While companies may be ghosting office space, their workers are showing up in real life to buy actual everyday stuff, especially stuff that stretches their dollar. Naveen Jaggi is with JLL.
Marshalls, TJ Maxx, Dollar General, Family Dollar, Dollar Tree.
Jaggi says over the last decade, discount stores have gobbled up the territory formerly occupied by the David's Bridals and Bed Baths of the world, a.k.a. the declining retail middle class. And inflation has accelerated that trend.
The U.S. consumer has only so many dollars to spend. And if they're going to go spend it, they want to get as much for their bang for their buck as they can.
If those empty Bed Baths are replaced by one of those stores with dollar in their name, that could present some problems for the Barnes & Noble or Old Navy next door. Joe Goodman is a marketing professor at Ohio State.
I don't want to make anyone upset at Dollar General, but you do want to be next to stores that have similar customers to you.
Although Goodman says most neighbors are typically better than an empty storefront, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Jack Ma, founder of the Chinese tech giant Alibaba, resurfaced in mainland China last month. He'd been largely out of the public eye since late 2020, when he ran into trouble with regulators. The reclusive billionaire, perhaps not surprisingly, did not respond to interview requests from Marketplace. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pack in Shanghai explains why Ma's whereabouts have generated such intense interest.
People who know Jack Ma say he's highly charismatic. In 2008, Chinese government broadcaster CCTV asked about his sunken cheeks and strong jawline. Here's how he responded. I am definitely not handsome, he said. But I wouldn't say I'm ugly. I'm just a bit odd-looking. Ma says he didn't make it on looks or family connections. In 1972, U.S. President Richard Nixon made a historic visit to China, including to Ma's childhood hometown of Hangzhou. Afterwards, foreign tourists started arriving in the city. They were Ma's ticket to learning English, as he told an audience at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in 2015.
So every morning for 9 years, I showed them around as a free guide, and they taught me English.
Ma later became an English teacher himself. And when China's economy opened further, he started working as a translator. And it was on a work trip to Seattle in 1995 that Ma encountered something called the internet.
So I searched the first word, beer. I don't know why, because it's easy to spell, baby. And I see beers from Germany, beers from USA, beers from Japan. But there's no beer from China. And I say, okay, type the second word is China. No data.
Nothing.
Nothing.
In 1999, Ma, with 17 partners, created Alibaba.com. The site helps connect small Chinese manufacturers to overseas businesses. Brian Wong from Palo Alto was an Alibaba executive for almost two decades.
We were at an event. We were explaining the homepage and all the things you put on that. And then somebody raised their hand. They said, well, what do you put on the back of the page? And I was like, what is he talking about? And they said, the guy literally thinks it's a printed page. These are like small, medium-sized business owners. Our salespeople were as much the educators as they were salespeople.
In 2003, Alibaba started the e-commerce site Taobao, and a year later, the mobile payment app Alipay. Along the way, the tech giant grew so big it virtually displaced eBay and Amazon in China.
Duncan Clark, a one-time Alibaba advisor, is author of the book Alibaba, The House That Jack Ma Built.
To describe Jack Ma's status in China, it's basically a Steve Jobs plus plus kind of scenario.
Clark says in 2020, the government started to grow nervous about the power of tech moguls and launched a crackdown. Ma was the first to be targeted. And some suggest that may have been because of a speech he gave the same year in Shanghai. Ma slammed Chinese financial regulators as essentially antiquated. Shortly after, Alibaba was forced to shelve the listing of its financial arm, the Ant Group. And Ma laid low, reportedly spending most of the last 2 years in Japan. Meantime, Chinese regulators have investigated the company and other tech firms like Tencent and Didi under anti-monopoly or data security laws. Tech stocks plunged. They rebounded slightly last month when Ma made a very public return from abroad to his home city of Hangzhou. Kendra Schaefer is with the Beijing-based consultancy group Trivium China.
I think the idea that Jack Ma's whereabouts are a barometer for the Chinese tech sector is a little bit overblown.
But she says she gets why global investors and the media fixate on Ma's movements.
There isn't a lot of great publicly available information in English on what the Chinese government is doing, saying, and thinking.
And some point out the government's move against tech giants may not have been all about politics. Experts say the sector is dynamic, but underregulated. Something former Alibaba executive Brian Wong points out in his book, The Tao of Alibaba.
It's possible that there was this need to kind of slow things down.
When Ma reappeared last month, Alibaba announced it would split into six smaller units. Despite that apparent concession, there's no word yet on the company's shelved IPO for its Ant Group. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I never scrolled down past the first page.
You gotta keep scrolling. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 66 points, 0.2% to finish at 33,875. The NASDAQ lost 35 points, 0.3% to close at 12,037. And the S&P 500 gained 3 points to end essentially flat. We heard earlier about the real estate angle on Bed Bath & Beyond's bankruptcy filing. Its shares plummeted 36%. Here's a look at how other big box retailers are doing. Walmart rose 0.7%. Target expanded 1%. Kohl's is down 0.8%. According to its latest annual report, the American Library Association counted 2,571 books targeted for censorship in 2022. That's the highest number since the group began tracking over 20 years ago. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.50%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace. Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. If you're paying attention, it's natural to feel despondent about the climate crisis. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, says average global temperatures will likely reach 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels within the next decade. That's a critical threshold beyond which we will face increasingly catastrophic effects of a warming planet. The good news is there is a lot we can still do. And that's the subject of a new book. Rebecca Solnit is co-editor and one of the authors of Not Too Late, Changing the Climate Story from Despair to Possibility. Welcome to the program.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You and your co-editor, Thelma Young Lutuna Tambua, have a very specific audience in mind for this book. Who is it for?
We do see it as for everyone. And we've had people say, for experts who are burned out and exhausted, that the book can be a kind of refresher reminder of, you know, what's possible, why we care, what we've done so far. But this is the decade of decision. We need people to participate. And so this book is really a toolbox to equip people with the ideas, the hope, the confidence, the context to, you know, go forth and do something.
As you say at the outset of the book, hope is not the same thing as optimism. And I'm wondering why that distinction is important and what it is. Why is hope different?
For me, optimism is really confidence that everything will be fine. And if everything's going to be fine, nothing is required of us. Mm. Hope for me is facing the uncertainty of the future, the fact that it's being created by what we do or fail to do in the present, and really engaging actively with what those possibilities are.
One thing you talk about is that hope takes a long time to become success or victory. And there's a great story about the young people who showed up at Standing Rock in 2016 to protest a pipeline. Tell me about this station wagon full of folks from New York who arrived at that protest.
Oh, I feel like this is one of the great lesser-known stories of the last 15 years or more. Standing Rock became this huge gathering of Native and non-Native people. For so many non-Native people, it was a crash course in understanding both climate change and oil pipeline politics and Indigenous rights and history. And so in the middle of that incredible gathering of thousands of people at Standing Rock, a station wagon set out from New York City with a bunch of young friends in it. And one of them was so influenced by what she experienced there, the commitment, the hope, that she went home and changed her life and changed from really feeling despairing and powerless to feeling she could do something. And as it happened, she decided to run for Congress. And of course, you all know her now as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the person who introduced the Green New Deal. And so indirect consequences are something I find really exciting. Standing Rock did not stop the pipeline, but it really impacted a generation. And so one of the things we really wanted to talk about in Not Too Late is the way that change works, which is often in these indirect, protracted, and complicated ways that nevertheless matter tremendously.
And the book is filled with examples of direct successes that may have taken a long time, but you have actually a list, an incomplete list of climate victories, which is pretty remarkable to read through. What was it like for you to kind of step back from the doom and gloom and recognize what people have been able to accomplish?
I don't think I ever stepped forward into that gloom and doom. I am hopelessly hopeful, partly out of sheer stubbornness and my sense that the fossil fuel companies would like us to give up and feel powerless, and the hell I'm going to give it to them. One of the stories I'm incredibly excited about in the book is by Renato Constantino, a Philippines-based climate organizer. He and others in the Climate Vulnerable Nations forced the world to set the threshold with the Paris Climate Treaty at 1.5 degrees, not 2 degrees. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, people think, you know, like it came down on the tablets of the law from Mount Sinai or something. But it was really a fighting point, and they fought a battle most people thought they couldn't win and won it against the 192 nations who were signatories. So many of the good changes come from the margins and the edges, from people who are officially deemed to be powerless and ultimately change things at the center.
As you just mentioned, you're not the sole author on this. We get to hear from lots of different voices through essays and conversations in the book. What was it like for you to work with others from all over the world, really, and hear from this perspective of scientists and activists and writers who are joined in this fight?
And Thelma and I assembled what we call our dream team. We thought of what we needed to cover: the science, the politics, the policy, the activism, the kind of moral and philosophical and emotional perspectives. And we have two IPCC climate scientists. And it's important to say that these people who are in the deepest policy workings in the scientific world are not hopeless either. And their voices were such an important part of the chorus we assembled.
Yeah, I was really struck by those two. Of course, the most recent IPCC synthesis report, you know, you talked about the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. It leaves us with the very urgent sense that if we're not too late, we are very close to being too late to escaping, hitting that threshold. And one of the things I took away from the book is that even if we do, there are things worth saving.
Absolutely. There will always be something worth saving. It is never too late in that sense. We feel a lot of despair, shame, anxiety about it. A world in which we didn't feel those things would be richer in these deep and profound ways. And that's worth working towards.
Rebecca Solnit is co-editor of Not Too Late, Changing the Climate Story from Despair to Possibility. Thank you so much for this book and for sharing it with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll get the latest read on consumer spending for the month of March this Friday from the Commerce Department. Until then, how about a quick consumer history lesson? Back in 2009, Congress passed the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure, or CARD Act. As the name implies, the law tightened up some credit card practices, including how aggressively credit cards are marketed to college students. Yanely Espinal is the host of our new podcast, Financially Inclined. She talks about what it was like for her to open a credit card in college before the 2009 protections were in place.
I'm from a low-income family, so getting a scholarship to college was the only way I was actually able to go. So I was really lucky, and I got a scholarship to Brown University in 2007. I think I had like $1,500 in cash in my bank account. I thought I was rich. And then once I got on campus, pretty much 2 to 3 weeks in, I had spent all that money buying textbooks and buying like all the things that I needed for science lab. So I picked up a job on campus. I was working at the pizzeria. I was basically going between class and work. Halfway across the campus, there was a tent set up with a little table and a bunch of papers and clipboards. There was this one woman with the clipboard, and she was just waving me down, kind of asking me like, hey, do you think that you would be interested in getting a student credit card, and it would help you pay for your textbooks and for a laptop? And I was like, oh, like I kind of need help paying for those things, that maybe I should look into this. I just grabbed the pen and I filled out the form. And I remember it was like all of the same information that you would put on a form for like your FAFSA or for like anything that was related to like applying to college. It felt very similar. It was probably just 2 or 3 weeks after I filled out the form. I remember walking up to my mailbox and feeling shocked that like, oh, it's already here. Like, I got it. And like, I opened the envelope so fast. I was like, oh my gosh, I got my credit card. Like, I think I felt like a successful adult. When I graduated from college, I had 4 different credit cards open, and 3 out of 4 of those cards were maxed out. So I never looked at my credit card statements when I was in college. I would just open up the PDF and look at one piece of information, which is minimum balance due, like your minimum payment due. And I was like, oh, it's $25. Okay, boom. So I would just send my $25. I never scrolled down past the first page to see what else was on the statement until I had like rent to pay and bills and responsibilities. And I felt like this isn't making sense. I need to sit down and go through it. And that's when I pulled up the statement and I started looking line by line, and I saw a lot of interest fees were adding up. I sat down, added up all the credit card debt that I had, and it was just over $20,000. That scared me half to death. And that was when I decided I have to do something to tackle this. It took me a total of 18 months to pay it all off. And that was a tight budget, a frugal lifestyle. But, you know, I wouldn't change it for a thing because it felt so amazing to finally not have that debt burden. It is always, always so hard for me to say that I regret spending the money, because I want my nieces and nephews and my little brothers to hear me say I regret it. But if I'm being 100% honest, like, a part of me is glad that I did it, because I learned through that experience. It made me passionate about viewing financial literacy as a social justice issue. If I hadn't experienced that in college, like, I don't think I would have had this passion for the work that I do today.
Yaneli Espinal, the host of Marketplace's podcast, Financially Inclined. You can find it on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. This final note on the way out today, a bit of a postscript to my conversation with Rebecca Solnit. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a blow to big oil and gas companies fighting lawsuits against them over their role in climate change. Several state and local governments have sued ExxonMobil, Suncor Energy, Chevron, and others, seeking damages to cover the costs of economic loss and climate adaptation. The energy companies had pushed to have the cases heard in federal court rather than state court, which is viewed as more sympathetic to plaintiffs. The lawsuits were filed by the state of Rhode Island and cities or counties in California, Colorado, Hawaii, and Maryland. The justices declined to hear the energy company's appeals, allowing the lawsuits to proceed in state court. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. Gold has been having a moment in the wake of the recent bank failures and cryptocurrency losses, though prices dipped back below $2,000 an ounce in the past week. According to the Wall Street Journal, Google searches for the phrase "how to buy gold" reached a record high this month in about 2 decades of data. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.